If you listen to this podcast and follow what we do at Troutbitten, then you're a thoughtful angler, and you don't accept the status quo simply because that's how it's always been done. Squall of Fishing designs and creates fly fishing apparel with this same philosophy. Squalla was started by a group of lifelong fly anglers who spent their careers working for some of the biggest names in the outdoor industry, and they understood that essential fly fishing apparel like waders, jackets, sun gear, and insulation could simply be better. So now, Squalla makes gear for us, the like-minded few, serious anglers who don't take themselves too seriously. Check them out at squallafishing.com. Water is essential for life, but for Orvis, it's the blood of the brand. Orvis has been the leader in fly fishing since 1856. No other brand can match the explorative and innovative spirit they bring to the water today. Everything at Orvis is about inspiring and empowering adventure and wonder in nature. Rooted in the vitality of fly fishing, fueled by passion and curiosity for the outdoors, Orvis designs and develops products and experiences, providing the knowledge and expertise to enable more meaningful moments and connections in nature. With over a century and a half of experience in the field and on the water, Orvis seeks to ignite that passion in others. This is the Troutbitten Podcast.
Troutbitten.
Troutbitten?
Troutbitten.
Troutbitten.
Troutbitten?
Yeah, Troutbitten.
Troutbitten.
It's about trout.
Wild trout.
This is Troutbitten.
This is the Troutbitten Podcast, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Dominic Swantoski. I'm the owner of Troutbitten and the author of Troutbitten.com. All right, here we go. It's good to have a full house this evening. The Troutbitten guys are here, and we're ready to talk about fishing through a caddis hatch. So 2 years ago, we did a full podcast episode on hatches. That discussion was a broad, overarching look at how the bugs, the insects that trout eat, really dictate many of the habits of trout. We argued that knowing the hatches, following the emergences, and being ready for these events is not only a lot of fun, but it drastically improves your success on the water. Trout don't miss the hatches, and neither should we. At the same time, none of us here think the pattern matters all that much, usually. I mean, it's a rare moment when you find trout selectively counting the tails on your mayfly spinner or inspecting the wing angle on your caddis dry. In fact, trout don't do either of those things, of course. They aren't reasoning and thinking about your fly pattern. It just needs to look natural, or should I say, convincing. And while we'll admit that a color change or certainly a fly size can make a big difference, I think we all can agree that what a trout eats most frequently is a great presentation. But what does that mean exactly? Well, for specifically caddis flies, we'll talk a lot about that tonight. And no, it's not always a dead drift, but it's not always swinging a wet fly or skittering a dry fly either. Most often, subtlety wins the day because caddis flies are pretty small, ranging from size 8, and that's a big one, to 20, but mostly falling in the middle range, 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s. Our goal this evening, then, is to walk through what to expect from the trout during a caddis hatch. We'll consider the whole life cycle, from pre-hatch, through the emergence, and even after the egg-laying phase. We'll talk about how the bugs move and how trout respond to those bugs. So, of course, to cover these stages, we'll look at nymphs, wet flies, emergers, and dry flies. Now, fair warning here, and hear this loud. We are going to generalize. Because our topic is caddis flies. It's not granums specifically, or boxwing sedge, or any other specific caddis. But just like mayflies, midges, and stoneflies, caddis flies mostly all share similar habits. So we'll focus on those common traits in this discussion, understanding that there are outliers too. So with that disclaimer, again, there is a lot to this one. So let me introduce the guys and we'll jump right into our topic. Trevor Smith, Dr. Trevor Smith, good to have you back, bud. Go ahead, Trevor, take it off mute.
Yeah, 0-1.
Not a good way to start, yeah. Dude.
Not a good way to start.
Season 11, your first podcast this season.
Right?
Could have done better.
Strikeout. Yeah. Things are good. Yeah. Life is busy, but things are good.
I was going to ask you that. I don't see you as much. We haven't been doing many back porch or front porch beers.
Yeah, we gotta kick that up again, especially with this weather.
Is it because the kids are getting older?
I think that's a little bit of it, yeah. Sports, they're doing some spring soccer, and so that's a little bit busy. Mm-hmm. There's multiple of them doing it. They're doing karate, and that's been really good.
Right on.
So, yeah, I know you and I have talked a little bit about martial arts and some of the benefits, and I've been enjoying kind of watching them learn more than just the physical side of things, but some of the mindset behind the practice. So
you got to have the right instructor.
Yeah.
Are you helping out with soccer?
So far, I'm assistant role. Yeah. We haven't done this league before, so it's pretty laid back right now. But there aren't that many parents that have played, I guess. And I did play soccer for a while, so.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. Soccer and baseball until I was in high school, and then football.
I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Full of secrets. Yeah. I've always said that about Trevor. He's done a little bit of everything. Did you guys know that, Mr. Soccer?
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Was a punishing defender. Yeah, a lot of that's lot your of specialty.
That's neat. All right. What do you know about caddisflies?
Caddisflies. One kind of interesting thing. I feel like.
Oh.
Here's an interesting tidbit. Is caddisflies versus mayflies. I don't know if you guys know this, but mayflies go through incomplete metamorphosis, which means that from an egg, they move into a nymph and then they hatch into an adult, whereas caddis go through complete metamorphosis. So they have a larval and pupal stage between egg and adult. So there's really four different kind of forms that caddis take, where mayflies just take the two. So when we use the word nymph kind of collectively for mayflies and caddis under the water, we're kind of generalizing and probably not using, we aren't using the correct entomologic term, but it, doesn't make a huge difference, because I think a lot of times we're talking about technique more than anything, but it does matter when it comes to, and we'll talk about this stuff later, but what type of caddis are we imitating? Are we imitating a larval form or a pupal form? Right. And based on that, what are the capabilities of that life form? And how does that help us target it? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is good. We'll get to that in the emergence phase. I should tell everybody, what we plan to do is talk pre-hatch, what the bugs are doing, what the trout are doing, and how we can adapt our techniques to look, like the flies, so the trout will respond to our flies. And then we'll talk emergence, kind of the second stage. But as you said, there's more stages to the bugs themselves. Then we'll also talk kind of what happens after the hatch, with the egg-laying phase. And then, death phase of the caddis. Anyway, we're going to break this discussion down, I think, pretty well. So that's neat. I have some thoughts on the pupil stage. Mm. Anyway, we'll get to all this. Bill Dell, what are you doing, bud? Tell everybody about your shirt. They can't see it, but tell them.
So I went to a county fair, and they had there was a company there that was selling shirts, and they had a nice big shirt with a giant palomino on it that says "Stay Gold," and so I picked that
classy.
Up. So it is the PA Gold Special.
That palomino may not be the proper term anymore.
Mm. That's right. Golden
Rainbow.
No,
that's right.
No.
Yeah.
So what it is?
That's what they want you to call them now. It's like everything else. You got to be careful what you call people. You have to be careful what you call the trout, right?
Well, I think it's how they get the color is different from an actual palomino. Like I don't know that there are any actual palomino trout genes in what we see in the golden trout that we have around here.
Who's a doctor they're now?
This is coming from Josh Darling. Let's introduce Josh Darling of Wilds Media.
Mm-hmm. What's happening?
Yeah, continue.
Well, so in part of my time at the Pennsylvania State University, I was in fishery science, and part of what they talked about, and I can't go into the terms that our good doctor here could, but they don't use palomino genes to actually get that golden rainbow. It's just it's stocked rainbow trout, and they just mutate the genetics until they found a version that produced a golden color.
Tell the truth, they just inject orange dye into them, don't they?
Potential or blue. Blue. Have you seen? Do you guys oh, yeah. remember that?
Right? Oh my! If anybody out there hasn't seen this, just Google blue trout, and then feel sorry for yourself that you ever laid eyes on
yeah.
that.
Yeah, Trevor. Maybe you could dive a little deeper into that and give us actually how that works, Trevor.
Let's not.
Yeah.
Quite honestly,
this isn't the PA Gold podcast.
No. Nope. But your shirt, though, stay gold. It says
it is beautiful. Stay gold.
Stay gold.
Right. I like the face on that. It's it looks like it was stocked.
Yeah,
snub nose a little bit.
Oh, okay.
It should be missing half a fin, and you know, yeah, be more authentic.
That would. Oh, we should create a shirt like that. What would the caption of the shirt be? Or it would be like "It ain't wild" or something like that. That's not a wild trout.
Born,
not a wild trout.
Bred to feed or something like that. What do you say?
Just stocky. It should just say stocky underneath.
Stocky.
It would be all bashed up. Like have nubby fins.
We could really piss people off and do a brown version with just connect all the dots.
Oh yeah
Pennsylvania tiger trout.
Mm-hmm. Oh sure. Josh, you think you could come up with the an ugly yeah. stocky trout?
Happily.
That's not
put
a
it
bad
on
idea.
A hat. Let's do it. The stocky
idea.
We do have some new designs coming out for summer. Did you know that, Josh?
I had no idea.
That? I'm going to pay you.
Had no idea. That's great.
You're about to get on something new.
I love being all right, paid.
Then. Yeah, you know, don't we all? All right, then, let's talk about caddis. Let's focus on the life cycle of a caddis and how trout respond most specifically to caddis flies around their time of emergence, meaning when they're hatching, right? A caddis starts as an egg on the bottom of the river. Then it hatches and it grows pretty quickly into an adult. In truth, a caddis spends almost all of its life under the water, so what we see above the water is only a fraction of what the trout see in the year-long life cycle of a caddis. Hey, let me mention right away here, there aren't nearly as many resources out there about caddis as there are mayflies. There are a few reasons for that, I'm sure, but honestly, I think one of those reasons is because Gary LaFontaine already covered it, all of it. I mean, precisely and thoroughly. Gary LaFontaine's book, Caddis Flies, first published in 1981. It is widely recognized as an encyclopedia on the topic. I have it right here with me. I mean, he covers caddis species, their habits, the trout response, and fishing tactics that meet the trout. It's one of my favorite fishing books. I've read it a few times now, and I'm not the only one who loves it. Gary died in 2002 at the age of 56. But he left behind a body of work that is unusually complete in an industry that more often just kind of scratches the surface of things. Anyway, check out the book Caddis Flies, and I'll leave a link in the show notes to a great article as well, also published by LaFontaine in Midcurrent. It's a perfect companion piece for this discussion. It really is. It kind of follows right along with what we were going to be talking about anyway. So guys, let's talk about caddis. How about we start this off simply with, what do you like? What do you look forward to? How do caddis hatches work into your time on the water? Now, we're going to dig deep into those three stages and everything, but what do you think about caddis in general? How does it work into your fishing?
I don't know. It's my favorite hatch of the year.
Hatches, yeah.
One, it goes on for the long, like caddis hatch pretty much from April-ish to October.
So it's your favorite bug.
It's my favorite bug. They don't follow any rules, so I feel like you can kind of get away with a little bit more and not have to have that pristine dead drift sometimes.
Right on. Good call. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think their ubiquitous presence on all of the streams we fish is something mm-hmm. that's really special. And I think to your point, Bill, the fact that you can count on them being around on almost every day from spring through fall right is on. Pretty special and makes for, you know, some strategic choices when it comes to fishing times between obvious maybe hatches. And, you know, there's very few days that there aren't going to be caddis in the trout's eye somewhere, you know, whether it's yeah, under right. the water or right. over the water or on top of the water. So you can love or be indifferent to caddis, but you can't ignore the fact that they are such an important and oftentimes more important life form to the trout in most of the water that we fish.
Nice. I like that they're tougher than mayflies.
Yeah.
You know, well, they, as I understand it, can handle more pollution, you know, a lot of times sewage treatment, no matter how well it's treated, often will put down mayflies or destroy the mayfly populations. But caddisflies can basically withstand a lot more than mayflies, seemingly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Trevor already mentioned this in the beginning, but the whole, what do you call it? Complete metamorphosis? Is that what mm-hmm. you called it?
Yeah, yeah, complete.
That makes them pretty unique just because for that reason, the trout see them in every column of the water. And
that's nice.
And somewhat regularly. And so I think that there are parts of what we do out there in nymphing that wouldn't be as effective if it weren't solely because of the existence of a healthy caddisfly population in that river, like mm-hmm. like higher tag flies, that kind of thing. And so I think that's really cool.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Nice. I think there are way more caddis than mayflies in most rivers. I think that's fair to say. Certainly in our rivers. And you've all turned over rocks and you've all caught caddis cases on your on the hooks of your streamers and nymphs. There really are. There are a lot more caddis flies than mayflies in most places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They love rocky, you know, like riffles, fast moving water and rocky bottoms are kind mm-hmm. of, and as I think about our streams around here in Pennsylvania, there's very few exceptions to that. There are some, but most of those are warm water fisheries that we're not spending a lot of time on for trout. Mm-hmm. But even in those, I mean, like to your point earlier that caddis are pretty hardy, there's even saltwater caddis and sedges. Yeah. So there's some coastal varieties that can even live in saline water, which is pretty crazy.
It is. Whether it's after a fishing trip or at a backyard fire, you can bet the Trout Bitten crew has a case of New Trail Broken Heels along with us. It's honestly our favorite beer. This hazy IPA is smooth and full-bodied. Hand-selected citra hops lead to notes of bright clementine and juicy ruby red grapefruit. Broken Heels is a keeper. New Trail beer is proudly brewed in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and delivered cold to your favorite craft beer retailer every week. At New Trail, it's not about being the best angler. It's about getting out there. So enjoy nature's moments and reward yourself for a day well fished with New Trail Broken Heels. It's Trout Bitten's favorite beer. Precision Fly and Tackle is a family-owned business with a passion for the outdoors and a sense of adventure. They are anglers who enjoy every moment spent on the water with family and friends. Precision Fly and Tackle carries the widest selection of Euro rods, reels, lines, leaders, flies, and accessories. From the beginner to the advanced angler, Precision Fly and Tackle can outfit every angler, no matter the budget. Visit them online at precisionflyandtackle.com. Then use code TROUTBITTEN10, that's the number 10, for 10% off your order. Gear up with Precision Fly and Tackle for your next adventure. So I'm kind of with Bill here. I think the caddisflies are my favorite because they are, as you guys said, from spring clear into the end of fall. I love that you can kind of run into them at any time. I love that they are more hardy, yes. I love that, like Josh, you said, they're up and through the water column in different places. They're just, well, again, ubiquitous. And I love that the caddis, is this fair to say, maybe they're a little more athletic. They're a little quicker.
For sure.
Both under the water and on top. And mm-hmm. like Bill, you said, the trout will respond to them if your drifts aren't quite as perfect. I do think a lot of what we do when we're nymphing does look like those caddis underneath. And that was your point, Josh, that, well, honestly, I think a bead looks like the pupil stage. And we'll get to that. I think that flash, that air bubble, possibly, I think that bead possibly looks like an air bubble. And I love just kind of exploring with a caddisfly. And I don't have a whole lot of confidence on most days, just exploring, you know, with a kind of a pure mayfly imitation. Yeah, depending on the water. It really does depend on the water. So do you guys think about caddis before they begin to emerge? Here's what I'm saying. Like, we all nymph a lot, and we know that. We'll fish dries any chance we get. But are you trying to match caddis specifically with your nymphs under the water? Like, year-round, I mean. Are you trying to match caddis cases, caddis that are out of the case? What do you think?
I have kind of two caddis patterns that through winter and early spring that seem to consistently produce. Like, it's not an all day, every day type things, but it seems like some days they get keyed in on it, whether it's like the migration from maybe there's more of that happening on a day.
Yeah.
But I like a Polish woven fly that is brown on top and chartreuse on the bottom.
Right on.
And yeah, like I use a waltz worm, and then I have, I don't know, there's about three or four different colors that I fish. Grobe got me hooked on that Jarco Czech nymph that he was obsessed with for a while.
He was. That was a couple years ago.
And
he tried to get me. I wouldn't buy in.
Yeah, it was too much work. You know, it was too many things on a hook. And so I've changed it where I don't put the case around it, and I just put dubbing on a hook, and I just put different shades of dubbing, and I'll put the hot spot on it. And so the other one is like the case, like everyone's favorite, the case caddis, which I that one seems to fish well in some of our rivers in the winter. Like it'll be a really hot fly sometimes.
I never do too well with a case caddis. I've tried almost every type of case after I read Gary LaFontaine's book for the first time. I tied, all of his patterns in there. Again, this is in 1981, so he doesn't have tungsten beads and stuff like that on his flies. But and really, this is in the late 90s when I read his book, and I tied them all. I tied them all, and I fished them, and there's a bunch of different cased caddis patterns in there. And I've tied modern cased caddis patterns, whatever you want to call them. I don't feel like, I guess through my own meager tests of that, I feel like trout aren't down there just picking off cased caddis, you know, plucking them off the rocks. You think so?
I don't think plucking them off the rocks. I don't know. My buddy
Greg
showed me.
But don't come dislodged. Yeah.
My buddy Greg showed me a pattern that it seems to fish pretty well.
Don't tell us about it. Greg will be really mad.
I won't. I know. I can't share his pattern.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
The only version of a cased caddis that I've ever thought maybe made a difference was less of a cased caddis. It was a waltz worm, but it was a green weenie tail as long as the body itself, the larva had almost entirely come out.
Sure.
And so the hook is obviously on the casing portion.
Well, and that, I mean, from my understanding of their life cycle, there are some caddis that have to change cases as they grow. So in their initial stage, the larval stage, as they grow, they might have to switch, and that's a really vulnerable time for them. But still, most of them are using silk to weave their little casing together,
no matter how the case is,
and then adhere it to a rock. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty durable bond.
Right.
And so it is, and oftentimes it's under the rock, and so it's pretty rare. I don't think it's a super super common food form for trout to be intercepting cased caddis, and also. Mm-hmm. Given what a lot of the caddis make their casing out of, it's a fairly heavy case.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's also sinking. You know, even if it got swept into the current, it would also fall out of the current quickly.
That's a good point. Never thought of that.
Certainly with the rock, smaller caddis, they make rock, little cases. And some of them use vegetation, and obviously those would float a little bit more. But
and stick case?
Yeah. But still, I think that it's like a really narrow food form. So
you know what I think? Looks a lot like a tube case caddis. Is just a pheasant tail.
Yeah, yeah, with a hot spot.
I mean,
right?
you know,
put a chartreuse hot spot on it and fish it during the spring,
or don't.
Yeah,
or just have it be a pheasant tail. I mean it. I think it looks a lot like it. But I guess that leaves me to my point that all year long, I use things that I think look a lot like a caddis. Bill, you brought up the waltz worm. It looks like a caddis case. Okay, it looks like a caddis larva out of the case. Okay, good. That's why we love those general patterns. A pheasant tail. Yep, looks like a caddis case. Also looks like a mayfly nymph. Looks like a caddis larva out of the case. Maybe with a bead on it especially, looks like a caddis pupa on its way to the top. You know, we love these general patterns. We love a lot of patterns, but we're not the only ones that have great success with these patterns that look like a lot of things.
100%.
I personally won't necessarily get wrapped up in the specifics, but maybe dark or light, definitely size, all of that. But I kind of keep using the same patterns that I was using in the wintertime when there were no caddis hatching.
Yep.
As these emergences start. You guys ready to dig in?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Deli's blowing bubbles. You see that?
He's getting bored.
He's very casual.
Cool cat over there.
Look at him. He's like,
Green like weenie hat, golden trout shirt.
Yeah, he's too cool to care. Look at him. Stay gold.
Stay gold.
What is that? Yeah. Pony boy? What is that? Is that a Outsiders gold. Reference, right?
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, stay gold, pony boy. Is
stay
that
golden.
It?
Stay golden.
Stay yeah. golden.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah, your shirt could be better if it said golden.
Might be a copyright.
That's true.
That's true.
It might be true, Bill. All right, guys. So our topic specifically is about fishing through a caddis hatch. That's the title. So this really begins with the emergence, the caddis hatch. We're not talking about just fishing caddis like through the winter when there are no hatches, but through the emergence. So let's start there. We said there's going to be three sections to this. So here's the first one, the pre-hatch. So as the bugs start moving down below, of course, near the riverbed, because that's where they just lived a whole year, as the caddis are staging or getting ready to hatch, what happens? Let's talk through that. Let's call this the pre-emergence or the pre-hatch stage. Now, three questions we kind of want to ask as we go through all three of these sections. What do the bugs do? You know, what are those caddis doing as they're, again, starting to move, staging, getting ready to hatch? What are the bugs doing? And then how do the trout respond to that? That's kind of the most important thing, I think. And then how do we present flies that'll look like, you know, the caddis so that we can fool the trout that are responding in those particular ways? Let's do it. Pre-hatch. What do you think?
So when do you think, quote, pre-hatch starts? Let's say that.
That's fair.
In my mind, I feel like the pre-hatch may start like a week or two ahead of time, where okay. maybe those bugs are getting, you know, there you might see a couple of them start to hatch here and there. It's not like mm-hmm. the full emergence. This year I noticed caddis flies fished really well right before the granums really started, maybe yeah. like a week and a half before I started doing better on caddis flies. Pupa.
You mean
pupa.
Nymphs.
Yeah.
Or the nymphs, yeah.
The larva. Sorry, not pupa, the larva.
Just throw out all the terms. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So low underneath. So that's a cool question.
I think that's interesting because, I mean, it just depends on the type of caddis. Granum are a little unique in the sense that that species, their hatch is a little bit more coalesced than some other species of caddis that tend to be more like hatching throughout the year rather than like timed hatching. Whereas the granums have somewhat of a, not only time of year they're specific, but also time of day specific, which makes them a little bit unique as a species of caddis.
So to Bill's question, do you know, just for the granum, for example, do they start moving around, lifted off the right? They're a tube case caddis, and we know that. They're tube case. We catch them all the time. They're very prevalent in all of our waters, this granum caddis hatch, right? It's our first caddis hatch, right? Kind of kicks off that season.
Yeah.
Still happening right now. Trevor, do you know if they're moving around a week before, a couple days before, 2 weeks before? So they're a tube case, and then, I don't know, do they lift off or start crawling around? Are they more active 2 weeks before they start hatching or like the day that they're going to hatch? That's a neat thing to consider.
Yeah. It is a good question.
I'm gonna
see if I can find an answer to it. Because my suspicion is that there isn't a lot of premonition for the like in terms of movement.
Right.
Like they split out of their their larval body as a pupa, and that's an event.
Yeah.
But like it would be to their disadvantage to crawl around much before that. So
there you go, good point. From what I remember, Bill, I don't think it's 2 weeks in advance. Now, like you said, you're going to have the tricklers, the ones that are a little early.
Yeah,
little early,
that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe that's the cause of maybe getting the trout engaged.
Right on. Totally. But Granum, the hatch today, I don't think he was moving around necessarily 2 weeks earlier. Just kind of getting ready, kind of going to visit my friends.
Right. But I think, I mean, there could also be some conditioning by the trout where they kind of... they begin to anticipate time of year and they begin to see, like you said, Bill, one or two are hatching and they begin to get patterned or conditioned to that color, to that life form.
So let's even say the pre-hatch is the day of, right? I mean it. Like, okay, this granum hatch has been going on. So this is a good example. It's been going on for 2 weeks. Is that fair, Bill? Almost 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, I would say.
In our area. And so the trout are expecting it every day. And the hatch, like you pointed out, Trevor, can happen at a certain time of day, although I will see that they're trickling off a little bit in the morning And for me, it's like an 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock thing around here. That's what I've been seeing. Sometimes even up to 4. I do think it depends on the water temperature. Bill?
That's what I was going to ask. I don't know. It seems like the longer the hatches go, the later they get. And then it is a big variance.
Yeah.
As far as like that pre-hatch, like if you get a really cold day, if you get a really warm day, it'll speed things up, it'll slow things down. And so it's not always, I don't feel like you can set your clock by, hey, the cranums are going to hatch at 10:05.
Yeah, certainly not. Like
there's a, I don't know, the more you're on the water, the more you see it, maybe the more you can gauge that. And you can say, oh, well, maybe I'll hang out a little bit today because it's a little bit colder. Maybe they will hatch and it'll happen at 1:30 or 2 o'clock, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about granums. And I feel like maybe it's beneficial for us to say, when we're talking about granums, we're talking about kind of like the quintessential like blanket hatch. Like it's what we see most often when we see like a bunch of insects emerging at once and hatching at once. That's what we're talking about. And so if you're wondering like what you're looking at, chances are if you're seeing a bunch of them at once, usually that's granums, not always.
Well, at this time of the year.
early in spring,
Yeah, that tan caddis though, boy, we really generalize around here, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
We don't get very specific about the Latin names of our caddis. We got
Brachycentris.
There you go. But no, Josh, you were saying?
That's kind of what I meant is that that's pretty much all there is to it is when we're talking about granums, we're talking about like the earliest caddis hatch. And we're talking about the hatch that's most known for those big clumps and clouds of caddis coming off and dipping and going kind of erratic. And usually they're darker. If you see black, usually it's granum. Not always, but a lot of times it's granum. Dark colored caddis.
So it's going on right now. And if we're talking about this pre-hatch, so every day the trout are almost ready for it. I think they kind of wait for it, to be honest, sometimes. Maybe it's water temperature specific when they're really going to emerge, but they'll start to trickle off. I guess what I'd like to think about is what are the bugs really doing down there for this pre-hatch? What do they do? They're a cased caddis in this case.
Right.
I like that.
They're migrating. They're getting out of the cases and then they're migrating from that larva to the pupa phase.
Changing from the
and as they do that, I mean the pupal phase is the first one that has any water mobility outside of crawling around. So the pupa can swim, or at least a lot of species of caddis pupae can swim.
That almost might get us into the emergence then.
Right. I do feel like caddis are tricky because they sort of have this like gray zone. But I think
so. They're moving around down there.
They're moving around, and
it's probably important to note that it's not like they have the power. And I think that we've talked about this before. They don't have the power to move around in the current that above that strike zone. But in that still water, right against those rocks, maybe there's a little bit of movement that the trout can detect.
So that's a great point. That's how we're thinking about what the bugs are doing. Okay. But then how can we adapt what we are doing to look like those bugs, basically, with our nymphs down there?
You want to get low. I mean, this is a stage of the hatch that you definitely want to present low.
Yeah.
And you definitely want to use typically a dark spherical, you know, shape that's going to match the size of the
like every other nymph.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
like the color of a pheasant tail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like a pheasant tail.
Yeah.
It's like dark and brown.
Personally... if it's like this time of year where there are caddis hatching, I skip over a lot of larval patterns and just fish like a low pupal pattern, like something. And as a pupal pattern, like I don't necessarily mean that I'm fishing like Fontaine's deep pupa or something like very specific, but just maybe even a pattern that has a little bit more of scruff to it that could, you know, that could look a little bit more full bodied like the pupal phase does. Rather than just a worm. Whereas if I'm fishing off season or when I don't feel like there's active caddis hatching throughout the day, I may fish in a larval pattern, you know, from time to time.
I feel like a waltz worm, for example, with its, let's say, bushiness, just simulates life, looks alive. Those little hairs that are moving back and forth, they can look like a larva, they can look like a pupa. And then I'm joking around about everything being dark and brown, but Bill, do you put, you know, it's Granum season, so the Granums are a really bright green, almost chartreuse worm larva. And do you build anything into your patterns, you know, to kind of represent that?
Yeah, a lot of times I'll fish like a hare's ear. I have two different kind of versions. I just fish the hare's ear. What I'm calling a hare's ear is probably not. It's just a hare's ear without a wing case. And so it's kind of lighter on the back, maybe a light tan, and then it moves to kind of like a darkest gray. And then I'll finish it with like a chartreuse hotspot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll kind of tie this a similar thing, but I'll put like a wrap of hackle around it or partridge. That is just
with a bead, or
usually
Bill does a fish split shot, so it has to have a bead.
It doesn't have to. Let's say I want to nymph fish it. So if like the pre-hatch is usually a pupa on the bottom, like a Czech nymph or the Polish woven,
right? And then off any the tag of those things fly, can look like it. Yep.
And then off the tag fly, it'll be, you know, kind of like a waltz worm. Usually, maybe I'll put something with a wrap or two of partridge or Indian hen around it. And then sometimes I'll fish it unweighted.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get it down?
I'm fishing the unweighted fly off the tag. So right, I'll fish a weighted fly on the bottom and I'll fish something unweighted on the top. And so so if I want to fish like a pupa pattern that's not weighted, like if I know we're in caddis season and it's a pre-hatch, that's kind of my go-to setup is at that point I'm all in on the caddis because I know... And then even the tan caddis, the early tan caddis that we get, they'll come off for an hour or two. And so kind of before that, if you've been on the river a couple of days and can kind of dial it in, you'll know, hey, maybe even an hour or so before that, I can get some really good nymphing in with caddis on the point fly and the tag fly.
The landscape is changing for trout anglers. No doubt you've already noticed another truck at your favorite access point and seen more anglers on the water. For those looking for new challenges and fishing opportunities, Trout Routes has the data to help you avoid the crowds and explore new public water. Trout Routes has mapped more than 50,000 trout streams across the country with curated, detailed maps of public land and access points. Trout Routes has developed integrated and interactive data, putting the tools in your hands to research new water and help you navigate in the wild to know exactly where you stand in the current. It's still up to you to find those deep pools and undercuts, but Trout Routes helps you get on the water, connecting you with resources like fly shops and stream gauges for trout water across the country. Download Trout Routes in the App Store today and visit troutroutes.com to learn more. For over a decade, Smith Creek has helped anglers just like you to free up your hands, hold your gear within easy reach, and keep our waters clean. Smith Creek's family of patented accessories are tested guide tough and backed by good old-fashioned customer service. Crafted from rugged materials like anodized marine-grade aluminum and UV-resistant nylon, Smith Creek products are hand-assembled with pride and built to last. To stay up to date on their latest specials and new product releases, be sure to follow Smith Creek on Instagram at SmithCreekNZ. Quality you can depend on from a brand you can trust. That's Smith Creek. I like what you said, all in on the caddis right there. That's how I am right now, whether I'm fishing or I'm guiding. I know the granums are, I mean, it's a blanket hatch, like you said, Josh. There's a lot of flies every day. I know the fish are ready for it. So it's like pre-hatch for me is almost all the time when I'm on the water. Until I really start to see the emergence, I'm kind of focusing on tactics that will help to simulate that pre-hatch.
Mm-hmm.
So when the bugs actually start to emerge then, and they make their way up through the, well, they start to make their way up through the water column, I mean, what really happens here? That's what we need to think about next. Here's the emergence then. We just talk about pre-hatch or pre-emergence. And now the actual emergence, I think it's probably the most interesting phase to fly anglers and probably the most interesting phase to trout. There's a lot going on here. They're coming off the bottom. And eventually, I mean, they're going to pop out. They're going to have to dry their wings, okay, but not for very long, not like a mayfly. Mm-hmm. And then they emerge. What do you have?
Yeah, I think this is maybe the part of caddisfly's life cycle that frustrates anglers the most because as new caddis fishermen, you've probably all had the experience of caddisflies coming off everywhere, seeing rises and yet getting very, very little success fishing dry flies, whether that's because there's such an abundance of options, or whether the particular life cycle you're fishing is not what the trout are keying in on, even though you see surface rises. Sure. And so I think, you know, what I'm thinking about, what the bugs are doing, like you said, it's a very quick, often it can be a very quick transition for them.
Much quicker than a mayfly, right?
Much quicker than a mayfly.
A mayfly.
And Granum's, the Brachycentris, like genus, is the slowest to take off of the water of all of
right?
the caddis species, which if you've watched them, it's still pretty fast, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's saying something that that's the slowest. But it is, the trout are often chasing pupae from the bottom to the surface. And so initially in a caddis emergence, a lot of what you're seeing as surface rises may just be trout swirling and turning as they intercept pupae on their way to the surface and then turn. And so you'll see their tail, or you'll see a swirl, and you may assume it's a surface take, but it's not. It's just
right
under the surface. So, you know, obviously how we present our flies, this makes a huge difference.
Right.
Right.
So what they're doing down there, from the larva to become a pupa, don't they, I mean, they're building an air bubble around themselves.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand, almost every caddis does this. Maybe all of them do.
Yeah.
That's unique. LaFontaine talks about how they'll take their tiny little legs, which have little hairs on their legs, and they motor them back and forth real quick, and it somehow makes an air bubble. Mm. And I think, I said this earlier, I think that perhaps our bead heads, our metallic bead heads, end up looking like that little air bubble. Perhaps other things that we include on our flies, like antron, right? LaFontaine has a couple patterns which are, well, they include antron. There's the deep sparkled pupa. Mm-hmm. There's the emerging sparkled pupa. It's antron, right? And the sparkly things, maybe even a wire rib looks like that, perhaps. Looks like, I mean, I think it's pretty unusual to have that air bubble.
Definitely.
You know?
It's a visual, it's strikingly visually. And can you imagine sun that can pierce that low, especially because these are happening in riffles oftentimes. And I think it's, I mean, I would guess that it's part of the reason that caddis so preferentiate the fast moving water, because they have enough oxygenation to maybe pull little teeny air bubbles and coalesce them into an air bubble they can use to emerge. But yeah, it's definitely a worthwhile thing to know.
It makes sense too then that with that air bubble they can emerge a lot quicker than a mayfly. I mean, like you said, they'll often just pop right out. I didn't know that the Granum was almost the slowest to emerge, but I know I have sat riverside eating lunch and just seriously just watched like a square foot of water during almost a blanket hatch, as things are really bugs are hatching everywhere, and I just see, it's like magic, here comes a caddis, pop pop. They don't spend much time, if any time, on the surface. Again, I know we are ignoring some caddis that spend a little bit more time, but in general, they are fast out of that water. Sometimes they have to hop a couple times to actually dry those wings. We're going to have the cripples. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But in general, they're really fast to emerge out of the water. So they don't spend a whole lot of time on the surface. They're not very available to the trout. Not nearly as available to the trout as they are during that emergence, while they are surrounded by an air bubble. And while they're in that surface film, which is another kind of part of this whole emergence, they'll get up to the surface film. And I love how LaFontaine describes it. He says it's like a human being trying to come up through 3 feet of dirt. That's a good, I mean, I don't want to come up through 3 feet.
Makes me claustrophobic to think about.
Right? It's not like they can just rocket up through the water. I'm sure some of them do, but for the most part, they're going to struggle at that meniscus. Is that what you call it? The surface film.
Yeah.
Not even this. It's just the tension, right?
Surface.
If they're smaller, I think that it probably makes a pretty big difference whether you've got like a size 10 or a size 18. Like that surface tension is really hard to
more
get
power
through for a smaller caddis fly. And for us, most of our flies are smaller. Like I think that 18 is a lot more common than 10 around here.
Good
and
call.
So like surface tension slows them down significantly.
The other factor might be that that upper part of the water column, that's the fastest the water's moving.
Sure.
Like the slower, the lower you get to the bottom of the riverbed, the slower that current, it's not as hard for them to fight through, where that, like you're talking about, kind of that surface tension, you know, it's the last 3 inches or whatever, 6 inches to get through that is the fastest moving part of the river. Because mm-hmm. I don't know if we officially said it, but the majority of these caddis hatches happen in skinny riffles. Like, let's say,
good point.
I don't know, mm-hmm. two and a half feet or less of water.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Moving water
yeah. with surface disturbance on it. And so that's mm-hmm. probably the fastest moving current yeah. in the river. And they're trying yeah, to yeah. bite through that at the top end.
I mean, we know that almost all nymphs, whether they're mayflies, stoneflies, even midges, but especially caddisflies too, are in often the fastest water that you can see. They need mm-hmm. the extra oxygen, even as their larvae. Well, that's where they live, right? So everybody calls that the food factory of the river. But now they're hatching out of this food factory.
Yeah. I think one thing to note too is just like cold, rainy days. That might be a day that you see them spend a little more time on the surface.
Sure.
They are a little bit prone to the temperature, and they are definitely prone. Their wings are similar in some ways to moths. Moths and caddis actually share
yeah.
like a larger entomologic grouping. They're not identical, but because they have that like hairy wing, water doesn't just like roll straight off it. And so
nice.
Rain can definitely knock them down onto the surface and keep them there a little bit longer. So fishing a caddis hatch on a rainy, cool day might be worth knowing that if you're going to spend a little more time on a surface pattern.
Which is why, like right now, early April, with the grano, which you keep going back to, yeah. I mean, you're going to have more of those cool,
yeah, right,
wet,
right.
Often we've had a lot of rain. And yeah, that makes sense. Just like a blueing olive, often on the cooler, rainy, especially days, yeah. and they can't lift off
right.
quite as well. I swear, the blueing has become my favorite mayfly mm-hmm. hatch.
I love that.
And this granum keeps getting more and more interesting as the years go by. So we're talking about what the bugs do. We kind of identified what the bugs in general are going to do, what most caddis are going to do. Mm-hmm. Transform from a larva to a pupa, make their way up top through that water column pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. They're swimming up through, or they're using the air bubble pretty quickly, get to the meniscus or to the surface film, and probably struggle a little bit, but then pretty quickly pop up through. I've always thought of it because they have the air bubble around them. By the time they make it to the surface, their wings are pretty much already dry. Whereas a mayfly needs to dry its wings. It's just sitting there like a sitting duck, just waiting, hoping to lift off, but probably or often being eaten.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's what the bugs do. That's what the caddisfly do. And how do the trout respond through this emergence?
I mean, trout are super opportunistic.
Yeah.
So it's in that transition between larva and pupa that I think that they see yeah. the most opportunity for a meal. And that's why, like when you're looking at a caddis hatch, your natural response is going to be, well, I'm going to tie on like a, you know, an X caddis or a CDC or, you know,
yeah.
elk hair, whatever you're going to do. And then you're not going to catch anything because that's just not what the trout are doing. Because they see an opportunity. They're like, well, what's the most vulnerable stage? The most energy that I'm going to have to output is going up to the top to get these things that are quickly getting out of the water. And I'm going to hope that I can catch it before it gets out. That's just generally not what they're doing unless mm-hmm. you've got a really thick blanket hatch.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that generally they're staying low unless it's really thick on top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you just sheer think of the absolute amount of seconds it takes a larva to move to pupa, to move to the winged adult in this mm-hmm. hatch, and you break that down by percentage, the percentage, you're like 95% of this process that the trout is seeing is occurring in the pupal phase, right?
Under the water.
Yeah, under. Exactly. So I think we could even just base it on mathematics at some level. That brown trout are opportunistic, exactly like you said, yeah. Josh. They're lazy and they do not want to expend more energy than they need to. So if they're seeing 95% of this thing I'm seeing it as a pupa, they're going to key in on that
mm-hmm.
and yeah. preferentially feed on that.
Sure. Deli, you have to have something there.
Yeah, so a couple of things here. For me, some of it plays into the amount of water. Like right now, with this granum hatch, a lot of times the water's higher.
Yeah.
And so those bugs might struggle longer to get to the surface.
Yeah.
And so higher waters, I might not see as many rises
Yeah.
Because you see caddis and they're out there and they're feeding and there's an emergence happening. That's not going to automatically mean like, hey, they're not eating caddis. They're eating caddis, but you don't see them.
Yeah. Good point, Bill.
You don't want to necessarily pay attention to what's on the air. You want to pay attention to what's coming out of the water at this phase.
Nice.
That's a good point too. Yeah.
Depending on the water level, like let's say your river's at an average flow for presentation, I really like dry dropper in this phase. Because they're kind of migrating up. I don't like tungsten beads for caddis emergence. I like a brass bead that's most times gold and silver. Like you talk about the air bubble. I think the silver is probably the closest thing you can get to that air bubble.
I like it.
On some rivers.
And just, yeah.
Depending on the water color.
Yeah. Huh. Some water colors have a real tea look. Copper works real good there.
Oh, that's cool.
I've never fished copper for caddis.
Emergence. No kidding.
Gold and silver. Yeah. Gold and silver is like my.
I'm with you on the silver. I think that probably looks the most naturally like an air bubble. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I use those pheasant tails just all throughout even the pre-hatch stage and then definitely the emergence stage. For me, it's a positioning thing more than even the pattern. But I like that. Keep going, Bill.
Yeah. I tend not to like. For caddis hatches, I rarely fish like a pheasant tail-ish pattern. I'm more into like the waltz worms, the hare's ear, like dubbier stuff that's like more buggier, that's probably looking a lot more like a pupa.
You ever put antron in it? You care about that?
I'll use flashy a little bit. Like I'll put a little antron in the head. Like they make like just the antron dubbing, but not necessarily like the shuck patterns. I'm not big on the shuck patterns.
I think what I heard the most, you guys were all nodding your heads. I think what I'm hearing, it is a position thing. You're not using tungsten, Bill, because you don't want to get all the way down. You're not trying to be underneath the trout's focus.
Yep.
I think during the emergence, the trout are focused, well, not right in front of them, not right on the riverbed, but up. They see the best opportunity for them, the easiest thing to feed on, those caddis, they're emerging. They might be lower mid-column, or even all the way up then to the surface, and perhaps on the surface too. But if we're talking about those nymphs underneath and perhaps the pupa underneath, I'm with you, Bill. Often, I'm not going to use tungsten, or if I am, it's going to be a small tungsten bead, whatever. For me, it's more of a position thing. They're going to eat my tag. Maybe I'll keep a Polish woven nymph on the bottom, but then I'll have my tag riding 30 inches up instead of 12 or 14 or 16 inches up. And I think that makes, it does, it makes a big difference. And so I'm trying to hold my target fly, let's say, in the trout's preferred zone for the longest period of time. And sometimes I'll even drop shot during an emergence. And I'll keep my drop shot ticking the bottom. And then I have my upper tag fly, if I have two. I'm trying to put it right in the middle or even higher middle, like upper middle column.
Yeah.
And that could be a very unweighted fly. I often use soft tackles for this, not to get too specific, but, you know, just a pheasant tail soft tackle, hare's ear soft tackle. Put a soft tackle on something that you already like. And that fly then will do a lot of good work for me. Mm-hmm. Even though I am down on the bottom with my drop shot or whatever, a Polish woven, if you don't want a drop shot, get something near the bottom and even ticking. And then every time that drop shot or the heavy fly ticks, then that soft tackle just kind of bumps a little bit, bumps a little bit. Does that look like a swimming caddis? Maybe.
Yeah.
And the fish sometimes say, yes, it does.
Right.
And it works pretty well for me. It works really well for me during that emergence.
That's cool.
The longer I'm on the water, the more days that I spend out there, there is no doubt I realize, oh, here it comes. Here comes the emergence. And I'm doing whatever, pre-hatch stuff like we talked about, and now I'm in the emergence. And I'm seeing the random rise. There's not even random. I'll see the fish come up two or three times, and he's starting to target some caddis that are actually making it to the surface, and he's eating them, even all the way on the surface. Or maybe like you said, Trevor, they're just porpoising, you know, and just eating right under the surface film.
Yeah.
Well, I love this period of time. The trout seem to really respond. And I don't feel like it's just necessarily one level, but multiple levels that I can have success in.
Yeah.
Like Bill, you're saying dry dropper. You're going to catch him on a dry. but you're also going to catch them on the dropper. Yeah.
I guess in the fun factor, like if they're coming up,
yeah,
I've nymph fished, you know, way more hours than I get the dry fly and dry dropper. I may not necessarily catch the most amount of fish doing it, but man, it's just more fun. It has its days. It depends on the water level, really. Like if it's at an average level or under, like if you get lucky and you hit a gaddis hatch and the river's a little bit low, which we're not doing anytime soon. But yeah, it's just so much fun because you can work like all those zones. And I'll play around with the dropper. Maybe I'll start with 2 foot off the back and then I'll short, like kind of as the hatch progresses, I may shorten the tippet section between the dry and the nymph, maybe closer to the end of the hatch. I've got it up to like a foot. Like for me, the closer I can put it to the caddis, the less kind of room for error with that. I do fish that brass bead. Mm-hmm. It has a tendency to kind of migrate into a different seam than the caddis, unless you're, you know, you can try your best, but not every cast is going to be perfect. Everything's going to be in one lane.
During this emergence, it's a lot of fun because I'm not trying to get to the bottom now, just talking about drop shot, but I was almost saying that would be an unusual thing for me to do. Usually during the emergence, I'm not trying to hit the bottom, you know, and like you're talking about, Bill, I am going to deliberately put my nymph somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Do you guys swing out presentations and when you fish caddis hatches?
That's like, a good question.
What do you feel like that's successful or works?
I'll kind of tinker with it. I've had days where, let's say I'm dry fly fishing and it's coming up to me, or if I'm fishing, like, let's say at like 45 and 45 looking at a bank.
Yeah.
I'll have a tendency during caddis hatches, that's when I will swing a fly.
Sure.
Because I feel like that swing and like that dropper or even the nymphs underneath, kind of that going against the normal current that's out there, that happens or could happen more in this situation. And sometimes it's a trigger.
Yeah.
Like I've had days where they're on that, where that's the presentation they're eating and it's back and forth, but it's just a fun experiment to try to figure out what kind of presentation and technique that they're going to hit that day.
Mm-hmm. Oak and Oscar is an American watch company that does things the right way, not the easy way, crafting mechanical timepieces that combine Swiss precision with American know-how. Oak and Oscar was founded in 2015, named after the owner's love of bourbon and his dog, Oscar. Their watches are built to withstand even the most adventurous fly angler. Our very own Austin Dando has been putting his Olmsted to the test since last year. Oak and Oscar is a watch company that loves fly fishing. Visit their website at oakandoscar.com/troutbitten. Mark your time on the water with Oak and Oscar. If you want to be an efficient and effective angler, you need to have your fly storage dialed in, ensuring that you have everything the fish might want to eat while also staying organized and focused. Fulling mill fly boxes are designed for just this purpose. With no frills, these boxes are built to work. With custom-made, durable polycarbonate shells, they're lined with dense, slotted foam that holds everything from streamers to tiny nymphs and dries. They feature strong magnetic closures that only open when you want them to. From their pocket box, which fits in your shirt pocket, to their Tactical Max, which holds 960 flies, Fulling Mill's range of 8 boxes has something for every angler. Grab yours at fullingmill.com or ask for them at your local dealer.
I've been thinking a lot about this, about swinging flies. Austin and I talked in the Critical Nymphing Concepts series back in season 10, just this last season, about the Lising Ring lift and about different things, different ways you can move your nymph for an induced take, Sawyer's induced take, and things like this. Sawyer and Lising Ring were both actually moving the fly with the current, not against it. Mm. And I would argue, if you think about this, is a caddis swimming against the current?
Probably not.
Yeah. I highly doubt it. I don't think they're swimming. Yeah, you know, I'm going to fight that current. Right. No, they're drifting back with the current, and they're also emerging up. Yeah. They're swimming up. Yes, yeah. So they're going a little bit slower than the current is going.
That's a great point, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so you can slow it down a little bit, but if you're just pure swinging,
right,
that might not look natural. But
if you're pure swinging, you might be holding that nymph, wet fly, emerger, whatever you're holding, in a zone for a really long time.
Yeah.
Right. When you're swinging.
Good point. Really good point.
Thanks. When you're swinging, you can really keep that fly in one zone for a long time. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I think that's the success of swinging. I think that's why it works. I don't think it looks natural. I don't think any caddis fly even is, I'm going to fight that current. But there it is, right in that zone for a long time, and then the fish eats it. I think they're looking for a certain thing in a certain zone, and you're holding that zone for a longer period of time. You can hold that zone in the same way, very similar way anyway, with that dry dropper. Like you're saying, Bill, just a foot behind your elk hair caddis, right? There's a lot of different ways during this emergence to have your fly look like what the real bugs are doing and how the trout are responding to it. They're fooled. They're in your net.
Well, I think also like as your fly comes under tension, you're getting a lift, you know, like whether you lift your rod or not. That fly, comparatively to a dead drift, you put that under tension between the, you know, your rod tip and the fly itself, all the current is lifting.
Nice.
And so I do think that there's an element probably in addition to the fact that you're holding one area that you're also getting this momentary lift.
Right on.
And maybe that's part of that induced take too.
Agreed.
That even without a lift to the fly rod. But yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot myself, interestingly. And I was thinking about like, and maybe you've tried this, Dom, but trying to do like almost a swing, but doing it like with almost like a section with the current. Like, can you find the ability to do that? And does that catch more fish?
I think that's what good wet fly fishermen do.
Yeah,
Trevor.
Yeah, totally. They anticipate.
They're not just pure swinging.
The tension, right? And they lead into it.
It starts with a dead drift. It starts with a drift. And then they'll start to swing up and not just pure tension, like just swinging 45 degrees downstream and across, swinging now.
Totally.
Good wet fly fishermen are doing something different.
I think it's why so often my own experience is that the take happened so quickly in that, like as the fly begins to swing out, the take is almost always early in that process. Dang. And I feel like that might be that response to that elevation in the current.
Fishing at night teaches us a lot about that, right?
Yeah. Totally. That's what I
know.
I was just thinking
that's
about.
When I wet fly fish the most, right? That's when I really start swinging things the most. And there are all kind of good reasons for that. So, to everybody out there, we acknowledge that we have not covered, you know, the pre-hatch and then this emergence. We've not covered it perfectly.
There's so much more to
this.
You could spend an entire podcast just talking about each one of these, and maybe probably you probably write a book on each one of these phases.
I know, right? And so I think that's the cool thing. And whatever, a trout bit, and we kind of like to, we like to dig into the details, and it's almost painful to just gloss over some of this stuff. But here we are. So we did hatches, you know, top level 2 years ago, just hatches. Oh my, everything. And now we're going caddis flies. Okay. Like you said, Bill, we could, and I think we will in the future here, and just talk about more specifically exactly what we're talking about during the pre-emergence, then this emergence. But we're about to get into the egg laying or this final phase that the caddis go through. But we talked a lot about the granum. And a granum is very much a blanket hatch for us, meaning like on the best rivers, on the best days, it feels like you almost can't take a breath without breathing in a caddis fly. You know what I'm saying? They'll be on your waders. You'll walk out of the river and you'll have 50 caddis on your waders. And they're everywhere on the best days. And so when the hatch gets that heavy, most certainly there are caddis who don't make it, you know, like the rest of their buddies. They call them cripples. The ones that, you know, don't make it out of the shuck. The ones that can't break free or break through that meniscus, that surface current. They can't quite do it. And so then they just die and they're right there. Or they're just kind of twitching around. They're still trying to make it. And those cripples are available to the trout. During these blanket hatches, when we really start to see rises, I feel like that's what trout are targeting. Again, we say like we're acknowledging trout don't have much of a chance at the dry fly caddis. They don't. Not in this stage, not in the emergence. They pretty much pop out. Again, they'll hop and dry their wings a little bit, but not much, not much. They're pretty much ready to go once they hit the surface. But those cripples, they didn't make it. And when you get a blanket hatch, you get enough of those cripples where the trout start to go, let me look for those. Let me look for those. I'm eating that one. I'm eating that one. And I'm eating that one. And I feel like that's what they're targeting.
Because those are, they're hesitating.
Right on.
The hesitation and the trout, like Josh said earlier, are opportunistic.
Yeah.
You know, that hesitation is like, oh, I've got an extra second. Yeah. Bang, I'm going to eat that.
Yeah. And I feel like trout are looking for that. And when you get enough caddis on the water, there's, to me, there's no doubt that that's what trout are targeting are those cripples. Which kind of dovetails into this egg laying, and let's say this final phase. Once a caddis hatches and makes its way into the air, they often spend days or even weeks topside. When I went back and read LaFontaine, caddis flies, I was surprised by this. I was like, really? Weeks? Mm-hmm. That yeah. sounds like a long time.
Way longer than mayflies.
Way, yeah. right. So it's very unlike a mayfly, which does not last more than like a day. 24 hours, right. A mayfly. As I understand it, a mayfly doesn't have a mouth that can drink, right? So they
or eat.
Dehydrate as soon as they're out of the water. But yeah, a caddisfly will go back to the water and drink mm-hmm. a little bit, go back to the water and rehydrate, right?
Right.
So these caddisflies, they make their way to the streamside branches. And we see this. If you just... Right now, if I go down tomorrow morning and I just start tapping the streamside branches, caddisflies will lift off from yesterday, maybe the day before. Heck, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago.
So you get holdovers.
The holdovers, I like it.
How long you been here?
What week are you from, right?
Yeah, right.
I've been around longer than you. Oh, you just hatched yesterday.
Class of April 13th.
That's right. They're bragging about it. They're bragging about it. So they often collect in the air together at certain times of the day. Often in the evening, as we all see that. And that's when some of them mate. I'm not saying it always has to be in the evening. I think it is air temperature and water temperature specific. I don't know that anybody actually has the answers. But we all have guesses. So the females lay eggs and then they die on the water. But many of the males die on the water as well. So in this final stage where they're laying eggs and then they're done, like what do the bugs do? How do the trout respond? And how can we present flies to the trout that look a lot like what the trout are seeing?
So we're talking about like the egg laying phase.
Yeah.
And I feel like there are probably lots of factors contributing to why an individual might unsuccessfully make it back off of the water because the females are touching down mm-hmm. to lay eggs.
Most.
They're making contact with the water primarily mm-hmm. to lay eggs. Surface tension comes back into play, which means they have to engage with surface tension of the water and lift back off again successfully. And that is not always possible, especially in this process when I think exhaustion is probably also playing into it.
Nice.
Effect like there's mating times. Involved. There's laying of eggs involved. There's engaging with the surface tension of the water. There's a lot of things involved. And I think that particularly if they're weak or the wings are wet,
nice.
Then they're struggling to break free of that water surface tension and attempt to lift off again. And so then you got like...
You have more cripples is what you have.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I think that's what we primarily call it.
Right.
Is we call them cripples. We call them spent caddis, you know?
Yeah. That's a good point, Josh. I mean, the females will dap and they hit the water hard. You guys see it. Mm-hmm. They hit the water hard to dislodge the eggs. Some of the females, according to LaFontaine, will actually swim to the bottom of the river and lay their eggs.
Yeah.
And then they might float up to the top.
Yep.
And again, there they are. Yeah. They're spent. They're once again available to the trout. The trout are going to eat when the caddis flies, mayflies, stoneflies, midges are most available. That's what they like.
Yeah, vulnerable. Yeah.
For me, this is the hunting dry fly phase.
Go ahead.
I've had certain times where I've hit this right where it feels like they've been laying eggs, returning to the water for hours at a time. I'm looking for shaded areas, bigger holes, kind of tail outs where, you know, ideally, if that bigger hole has some vegetation, shrubbery or something along the bank where those, where they've been kind of hanging out.
That's true.
And so I'm hunting for that kind of like slick or, at this point, I don't want any surface disturbance. I want to.
Interesting.
And I'm not fishing dry dropper most times. It's dry or die at this point.
Nice.
Because the surface is a little bit smoother. And so I want as least disturbance as possible when I'm throwing a fly to a bank or something. And I can be more accurate because if I'm going to put it close to that bush, that dropper could hit the, could, you know, hang up with the way the cast is. And so a lot of times I'm just throwing a dry, whether it's an elk hair caddis or like a Cooper bug or a devil bug, whatever you want to call it. So I'm throwing it tight. Usually the better fish are in, like, pretty much in the bush.
I know.
And so you've got to just kind of, hey, you know, come out, you know, they'll come out for a little bit and feed. And so, yeah.
Do you think those bigger fish in the, like under the bush, are there looking for egg laying females, or are they there just like waiting for things to fall out of the bush? Or is it like
all
when you've
above.
Seen
yeah.
all the above? Yeah.
Agreed.
And I do think the fish are going to migrate, and it might depend on the stage of the hatch. Like if you're nearing the end of the hatch, like Dom was saying, like the bugs that have been around for a week or two, there's going to be more stuff to feed on near those bushes in those bigger pools than necessarily to in the riffles. Like I had a day last year where I nymphed through riffles and I was like, oh man, I'm going to crush them, and didn't do anything really, maybe a couple fish. And I got up to a flat pool and they were working, you know, it wasn't like a fish was rising, you know, every minute.
Yeah.
But like if you took your time and you spent and looked and said, okay, ah, that fish rose like three times there, maybe in the last 5 minutes, but like it was feeding opportunistically. And so if you would go and present that a good drift to that fish, it'd come up and eat it.
Nice.
And I think they're both fun.
Yeah.
I would say I've had better luck in that egg laying phase as far as like the bigger fish goes.
Yeah.
That's cool.
At least on dries.
I think too, at that phase, they are the most available to the trout on the surface. Imagine you even have more cripples that are crippled from the emergence mixed in with now the cripples of the, just the dead caddis flies that already laid the eggs and they're done. Or the females that just tried to dap, and they got stuck in the film, like you were saying, Josh. I think at that phase, you have more caddis that are available to the trout. So now it's big fish time.
I mean, if we look at most of the instances in our water, like the water that is most adequate for these hatches is not covered by overhanging limbs and shade and stuff.
Fair.
A lot of it is out in the open. And so it only makes sense that for the trout that are most seeking out protection, that this is the best phase for catching them.
Yeah, right on.
Because this is the only phase that is going to cause vulnerability there.
A lot of times too, that backwater is right under the bushes, like you're talking about, Bill.
Right
next to the bank. That's lowest water where things on the surface are collecting in the foam lines and the bubbles and the backwater.
If you think about it, that's the easiest place a fish has to hold and feed.
Yeah, nice.
And so the smartest fish, maybe the biggest fish,
the dominant
of the river, are probably going to be in that location holding that lie because it knows, hey, I've been around this bush a time or two.
That's right.
Because most of the caddis eggs get dropped in the riffles, which is where they then are part of, you know, like we've talked about how caddis are most often living in riffles, shallow riffles, right? And that's where a lot of the eggs get dropped. I'm also kind of curious whether there's just a higher proportion of insects on the water because some of those females that are exhausted just kind of lay down on the water after dropping eggs or... You know, like I'm just curious what accounts, because I'm 100% with you guys on the fact that it does seem like it's one of the best dry fly opportunities. But I guess I find it interesting then that in the more slick water or more unbroken water that the fish are keying in, they must be seeing more flies on the water. So I'm just kind of curious how long it typically takes a female to completely exhaust after dropping her eggs and whether it's pretty common for her to lay down on the water afterwards. And I don't
know that answer.
Wasn't able to find anything on it.
No.
But
plenty of the males make it to the water as dead caddis as well. I mean, there they are available again. If it's not moving, it's available.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is like the trico spinner. That's why we all love fishing tricos. Again, it's a rise form. We should do a whole podcast on rise forms because that's what signals to you, kind of, that now they're out of the emergence phase and now the trout are focused on this final stage. They are eating dead caddis flies a lot of times in this final stage. I guess that's what we're saying.
This phase, you're looking for sipping.
Nice. Right.
Like where the emergence, it's either splashy rises or if they're taking the pupa, maybe they may be launching out of the water. And so like pay attention to all, like, I don't know, if they're coming completely out of the water, they're probably eating some sort of nymph. If they're, you know, splashing on the surface and probably eating a dry or even a pupa in the last, you know, second. But if they're sitting on a bank and sipping, they're mostly eating the dries
right at
that point. And that's kind of why I say, like, hey, I'm not going to put a dropper on because if I'm fishing that phase, it's going to get me in more trouble and it may not catch me more fish.
Yeah, because when you're trying to get tight to the bank, you need that accuracy of just one fly, you know, and then tight to the bank, that's where that water often is. You can find it out in the middle too, I guess, every once in a while. Hey, you know what everybody's going to be thinking about? It's like, hey, what flies then? We talked about it during the pre-hatch and during the emergence, but what flies are you thinking about for this final stage on top? Well, like, I think we're all saying it's on top.
Oh, never mind.
You suck.
A Cooper bug or a devil bug.
What's a Cooper bug? Which I don't know about that.
Don't worry your pretty little head. You'll just be fishing that out there.
I'll Google that. I'll figure you out. Cooper.
I don't know. Yeah.
Panfish on the Fly has a good tying tutorial on the Cooper bug.
Okay.
I think I think Cooper came first, and then it was rebranded as the Devil Bug. I might be backwards. It's a very old pattern.
It's a Rapala, isn't it? It's a Rapala.
Yep. It's a Rapala.
It is. It's got six treble hooks on it, and you just throw it out and snag them on the top of the film.
Whatever it takes, especially when the flies are dead and the fish are just sipping, just rah, right into their face. They fight better when you foul hook them, right, Bill? He won't answer.
There we go. Yeah. Couldn't get off mute. Yeah.
He's like, I'm not.
Hook him in a butt with a treble hook and he'll give you a ride.
My favorite topwater patterns, honestly, anywhere through the hatch, are an elk hair caddis. More and more, as the years go by, I keep using CDC more and more. CDC and elk. Because it just looks like everything. It looks like something that is stuck in the film. And it's just like just wings, legs, whatever, laying in the water and just kind of swimming around.
It's like the pheasant tail of
it is
caddis flies.
Nice. Of dries. And I do use an X-caddis. You brought that up earlier, Trevor. Yeah. Those are my three up top. That's all I'm using. Anybody else?
Truthfully,
yeah.
I only use two flies for caddis on the top, and I only tie of them, two of them, and it's the X caddis and it's the elk hair. That's it.
Della, you tie some pretty bushy elk hair caddis.
Yeah. So I had a client that actually reached out and was like, hey, I used that caddis we did the other day. He's like, that thing floats like a cork. It didn't sink all day.
I know. Like, you hardly even need floating.
Whatever the amount of hair for an elk hair caddis that it's calling for, I'm probably 3x times that. Yeah.
So that's not, honestly, now in fairness, is that the best fly for this final stage where there's dead flies?
That's why I said I'm using that Cooper bug or devil bug almost all the time in this phase.
So we're all going to go Google the Cooper bug.
I sent you a text with it.
Did you?
What's that? What were you fishing the day that we filmed? We filmed that fishing film with all of us.
CDC and elk.
No, he called it something else.
Oh,
is that it?
Deli.
Yeah, that was it. That's what I was fishing.
That was it. That was the devil something, right?
Yeah.
I remember that. That was a cool fly. It's kind of like if you tied it like a humpy and you cut off everything else, right?
It's basically a tan beetle.
Yeah.
Seriously. Interesting.
Yeah.
If you look what a caddis comes back to the water and looks like, it doesn't look like anything. If you look at the fly, you'd be like, that looks like crap. But like if you put it on the water next to a real one come back to the water and like kind of laying and kind of fluttering a little bit, it looks very much like it.
Yeah, I remember. I took a picture of that day because it was working really well. And it was around the same time of year. Mm. Austin says...
Austin texted us?
No, he texted me. He said, how things go, so we're not done yet.
Yeah, right.
He said, didn't it start at 8:30? Yep. He said, it's just a caddis. It's just a caddis.
That's perfect. Well said. No, so I knew we would go long on this.
That's why he's not here.
That's all right. Again, we're to the end, but we acknowledge we have left so much on the table. Go do the research for yourself. Go enjoy that research. Go, I don't know, have a lot of fun. Read Gary LaFontaine, Caddis Flies. Check out that article that I talked about. Go fish these caddis flies for yourself. Talk to your friends. Keep an open mind. Understand how they are very different from mayflies. Of course, they're very different than stoneflies and midges too. And when you're fishing a caddis fly, think about these three stages. Whether you are in that pre-hatch or that emergence, or all of a sudden it's kind of transformed from the emergence to now that final stage. Anything else, guys? What do you have?
Stay gold.
Stay gold.
Stay cold.
Stay cold.
Hit the bushes. I would say if you're in between phases and you want to have a better chance of catching a fish on a dry, look for bank vegetation.
Nice.
Whether it's bushes, whether it's trees. If you're blind casting that dry, put it tight to that stuff.
I was out with my friend Terry and his stepson Eric, and we were having
the Varners.
That's right. We were having an okay day. And there were a lot of caddis around, but the hatch just wasn't happening that day. But those caddis left over from yesterday, the day before, hell, I don't know, 2 weeks back, they were on the bushes. And every time I would touch a bush, I mean, there were a lot of caddis flies coming off. So I got the bright idea. I got up on the path, such as it was. I told Terry, stay there. I'm going to go hit some of these branches and try to get some caddis flies to come off and then hit the water. That's exactly what happened. And I mean it. Bang, bang, bang. We had three rises in a row. And one of them, there was a rise and a rise. They ate Terry's caddis fly. It was crazy.
Wow. That's cool.
It was
one of my, guide hack.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite moments of guiding ever.
You were chumming for him.
I was chumming, essentially. You were chumming. Throwing caddis flies in the water. It's one of the coolest things.
That's cool, though. That's cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Recognize what's around you. That's the mystery, right? That's what we talk about all the time. Everything is different every day. And it might be a lot like it was yesterday, but a lot of times it's not. So keep your eyes open. Look for those caddis flies, you know? There's a lot of neat stuff happening from the riverbed all the way to the surface.
Yeah.
Hey, Josh, darling, will you read us out?
Absolutely. Remember, the Trout Bitten podcast is a free resource for all anglers. Yeah. The Trout Bitten website hosts over 1,000 articles with endless stories. That's a lot.
It is.
Commentaries, tactics, tips, and more. Find what you like through the top menu and through the search page. Navigate by way of the categories and tags, too. Be sure to find the Trout Bitten YouTube channel, now featuring the Trout Bitten Tip Series, the Fish and Film Series, and the Trout Bitten Fly Box, all in collaboration with Wilds Media.
That's you.
That's me.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Trout Bitten Podcast. Please give the show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave a comment because that really helps. Until next time, friends, fish hard, enjoy the day, and find your life on the water.
Hey now.
Carabellation.
Ah. Like every other nymph.
Yeah.
Like the color of a pheasant tail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like a pheasant tail.
Right, yeah.
Ah.
It's just a caddis.
Ah.